Christian nationalism. There's this idea, a broad group of Christians in the United States believes that this country was created and founded as a Christian nation. To make a great nation again, we need to go back to the roots, so to speak. And we need to revolutionize the way our country relates to its laws, its morality, its religion, its education, its media, and all these different things. Christian nationalism. You've heard of this idea, right? It's been around in the news a bit. One of the features of many Christian nationalist groups is an idea called the Seven Mountain Mandate. Have you heard of the Seven Mountain Mandate? Yeah, a couple of you have. The idea is that Christians need to infiltrate every aspect of our society, and they have these seven spheres: economy, government, family, religion, media, education, the arts, all these things that we need to enter into and take control of so we can make our nation great again. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want you to misunderstand. I think that Jesus is the answer for every one of these aspects in life. He's the solution to the brokenness we see in marriages and families. He's absolutely the foundation of all education. He's the solution for the violence and the partisanship and the immorality and witchcraft that we see in the media and entertainment. He's certainly the solution for the greed and the power that is sought in modern capitalism. And of course, he's got the best government that the world has ever known. And yet, you know that word but? It modifies everything that comes before it, right? This is true. Jesus is the answer to all these things, but if God's church pursues these things in a method that Jesus would not condone, then they only will advance Satan's agenda. The idea that the church should reach into politics and wear down the barrier between church and state in order to promote Christian values is tempting, but this method of securing godliness in our nation is Satan's design. One of the pivotal beliefs of our particular church is the belief that we have freedom of conscience. Individually, we should have the freedom to choose how we serve God, how we worship. This is fundamental to who we are, and we even have a department called Religious Liberty, and we have lawyers that we employ all across the United States that pursue freedom for people. Doesn't matter what denomination or religion you are, if you're Hindu or Muslim or Baptist or Seventh-day Adventist, it doesn't matter. We're going to pursue liberty. So if somebody comes to us and says, we've got a problem, my freedom of expression of religion is being violated by the business that I work for or by the government in some way, we're going to go to battle for them in the courts to make sure that they can have freedom. That's how much we care about this. As a church that's built our legacy on the Protestant Reformation, we understand what happens when churches get their hands into politics. You can read about it in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, where the church is described as a woman, a harlot, that sits on a beast, which the Bible says in prophecy, a beast represents a kingdom. So this is a church, but not just a good church. She's an apostate, and she controls, she sits on and leads a nation. Now, this is important because the church that holds the reins of the nation isn't a good church. It's corrupt and it's fraudulent when it seeks to control government. Now, while Revelation had predicted what would happen in the future, we're looking back from our day into the history, and we can actually see this stuff happening. And you find back in the time, well, for 1600 years, the church in Rome held the reins of European governments, and she would say whenever she wanted to, bring your armies, we need to go fight this group of people that don't agree with us. And they invented amazingly awful torture methods to try to persuade people and abuse people who didn't agree with them to come back in line, and torture and death and This particular picture that you see on the screen is actually a wood carving that was printed into Martin Luther's Bible when he translated it into German, violating the church's command that it has to be in Latin. And he's like, no, the local tongue. So he puts this in his Bible. Interestingly, Martin Luther ended up adopting some of the same methods as the church that he was protesting. The Lutheran Church in Germany authorized German states to go to war against cities and towns that refused to become Lutheran, basically authorizing a policy of conversion or death. Zwingli, Ulrich Zwingli, he became the basically de facto leader of the Protestant Reformation in Switzerland, and he was given the political authority over the city of Zurich. They were basically like, here, be the mayor. But at the time, the cities were kind of city-states, and so he's more than a mayor. He was more like a governor or something. And so when the Anabaptists started saying, hey, Zwingli, can we talk to you? I think there's something else in the Bible that we haven't been talking about. We need to explore this more. Zwingli administered punishments of prison and even death to keep them from talking about what they were finding in God's word. I'm convinced that it doesn't matter how pure the church's theology might be or how sweet its disposition, when any church gains political power, it will eventually persecute those that it disagrees with. We've been in the Word for the past several months, and if you've been following along, we've just read Daniel and Hosea and Joel. And unfortunately, we don't have time to go through every idea in every book of the Bible, so we're just going to focus on one idea from the book of Daniel today. And it's, I want you to pay attention to the God who invites us to live in freedom, no matter what our government looks like. Daniel was one of the remnant of Israel who came from Babylon came from Israel into Babylon in exile. It wasn't a nice experience for him to come to Babylon. He was forced into this situation. And he's put in this environment that he doesn't really like. He was trained in politics in the king's school. One day, the king had a dream that you can read about in Daniel chapter 2. And the dream was a depiction of the future. But no one could tell him what the dream was or what it meant if they didn't know what it was. And so he began to institute some policies of destroying all of his wise men. And Daniel interfered and said, can I pray about this? Give me a night. And he prayed. And God gave him the dream and revealed the answers to him. Now, of course, if you've studied Daniel chapter 2, you know that each one of the pieces of metal in the metal man image that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed represents a kingdom. The head of gold represented Babylon, and then there's Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, the European nations, and then finally this rock that's not cut out, or that's not made by human hands, comes and destroys all of those kingdoms of men, and God sets up his kingdom on the earth. Now, even though God gave this dream to Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar was not a God-fearing man. He was a pagan, and he didn't care anything for the God of the Israelites. And so in Daniel chapter 3, you find that Nebuchadnezzar is trying to burn Daniel's friends alive because they wouldn't worship his pagan idol. So God gives him this vision, even though he's one of these nations. And each one of these nations is a persecuting power. They hold influence over a huge amount of the world, and they persecute God's people. Nebuchadnezzar himself, the one who gets the dream, is a persecuting power. And every single one of the others would end up being a persecuting power as well. And Daniel ended up having a bunch of dreams about this. Daniel chapter 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 and 11 and 12 all are repeating and enlarging on this progress of nations dream that Nebuchadnezzar had from Daniel 2. And what we find in this, whether it's a head of gold or a lion with wings or a bear or a leopard or a goat, or the king of the north, or the king of the south, whatever the symbol was, each of these depicts a god who is the architect of history. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't in charge. God was. And we find this really important realization is in Daniel chapter 2. When Daniel talks to the king, he makes this statement in Daniel 2:20. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. I apologize. That was actually the prayer he prayed in thanksgiving to receiving the vision before he talked to Nebuchadnezzar. He also told Nebuchadnezzar that this was God giving him the vision, but this is Daniel's perspective of God. He's the one who makes nations and tears them down. He sets up kings and removes them when he chooses. God is the architect of history. I think that's really important for us to understand when we face the question of what do we do when life is hard? And especially, what do we do when our government is bad? The prophecies of Daniel show us that history isn't random. No king or court or legislature or prophet or sorcerer can change what God has determined will happen in the broad strokes of Earth's history. God is the architect of history and time. History is marked by its persistent war against God's values, against truth, and against God's people. Just as an example, Israel was enslaved by Egypt. When they got out of that, they were persecuted and oppressed by the nations that surrounded them. And then after they rebelled and God allowed them to, they were taken into exile in Babylon. The followers of Jesus, many years after that, were persecuted by the Jews, then by the Romans, then by the Christians. Other Christians began to persecute people that didn't agree with them. What we find if we look at history is that our moment today in our little space in the world is kind of unique. To live in a place, a society that's free of coercion and doesn't have persecution is an anomaly. The Bible describes the freedom that we experience in the United States as the result of Earth absorbing the violence and the persecution and helping God's people. The word that Revelation uses for God's people is the woman. It says the woman was fled into the desert. And it says in Revelation 12, 15, I apologize, I was there already. The serpent poured out water like a river out of its mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood, but the earth came to the help of the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. This is a description of the geologic, you know, the location, the physical location in the earth that would allow God's people freedom from this oppression. And the United States has been that nation, that place on the earth that has provided freedom and safety. And the separation of church and state so that we don't have that persecution. But Revelation 13:11 says something interesting about this nation. It says, I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon, which suggests that this like Christian nation is still going to do the same things that every other persecuting power before it has. It's going to force people to do what they want to do about their beliefs in God. This nation who looks like it follows the Lamb is predicted to become a persecuting power. And Revelation 13:15 adds, it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the beast to be killed. So I don't believe that we should be, let me say this differently, I don't believe we should not be asking ourselves how we can make the government good. I don't think that that's the idea that God is going for. You look around at your environment, you're Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar's the king. The question isn't, how can I fix this government? How can I replace this king? That's not ours to ask. If we had the power to change our governments, history has told us that we would simply become the beast power that we are trying to fix. We would become the persecuting power. See, God is in charge of setting up kings, not me and not you. The question we need to be asking isn't about how can we change the government, but how has God invited us to live when our government is bad or when we live in a persecuting nation? And I think Daniel gives us some good examples of what to do in these environments. here's three principles, and forgive me, these aren't scientifically vetted, they're just things that I notice, so there probably are more, or it could be expressed differently, but I think these are worthwhile to pay attention to. The first principle is adapt, don't compromise. Now, I think this is really important because some people think that every adaptation is a compromise. But think about Daniel's experience. He grew up in a Jewish environment. And in Jerusalem, he had a certain culture, he had a certain economic pattern, he had certain norms for how he related to his family and to religion, and he had values and all these different things that he did, religious practices that were regular in his life. And then he's brought to Babylon against his will and forced into this environment with different food, a different religion, different philosophies of education and government, a completely different culture, and he was given a different name. Notice in Daniel 1, verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. Think about these names. Daniel means God is my judge. Belteshazzar means Bel is my judge. Hananiah means under Yahweh's grace, but they changed his name to under Aku's command. Mishael means who is what God is. Meshach means who is what Aku is. And Azariah means servant of Yahweh, but then his name got changed to servant of Nego. That's not very nice, is it? If my name was servant of Yahweh and I came to a country like Babylon and they said, we're going to call you the servant of Nego, I would be like, no, that's a big identity change. I'm not the servant of Nego. Don't call me that. That's not my name. And yet Daniel didn't object. You see, nowhere in there that Daniel or his friends rejected those names that they were given. It's like, hey, call me what you want. It doesn't change who I am. He was willing to adapt in that environment. He adapted to the education. In fact, he was one of the top in the land when it came to education. He's in a pagan school, and he gets high marks. In fact, he's basically the valedictorian, yes, of his class when he comes before Nebuchadnezzar to answer this dream in Daniel chapter 2. This is a guy who is excellent in a pagan school. He adapts. But there are some things that he's like, no, I'm not going to adapt in this way. And one of them was what he did with his own body. He's like, my personhood is important to me, and I'd really like to not eat that food. Thank you. And then he also wouldn't adapt in his commitment to God. Notice he's faithful, and 2 years in, he's been in this pagan school, he's been in this pagan environment, and under all these different influences, and he's adapted in so many ways, but when he stands before Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2, verse 27, Daniel says to the king, no wise men or enchanters, magicians or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to the king what will be in the latter days. God is the God of heaven, my God, he's the one that's given you this vision. He's not ashamed or scared to say, I'm still a follower of God. Amen. So he's willing to adapt, but he will not compromise. And I think that is super important because it gives us permission to be Christians, to be followers of Jesus, and to be good citizens in our environment. We don't have to be contrary to everything. We don't have to say, no, I have to have my way, my culture, my systems, in order to be good citizens. We can adapt, but we should never compromise. No matter what your circumstances are, you always have freedom to follow God. I want you to understand that, and this is something that I think should just seep into our souls. I have freedom. Not because my government gives it to me, but because my God has given it to me. The second principle of living with a bad government is this: let God initiate and then faithfully tell his truth. Have you heard of Bible bashers? Yeah, there's also Ellen White bashers. people that just, they have to tell you their thing. Let me fix you. Let me tell you what's true. And they bring the Bible to bear in every circumstance, trying to correct every behavior and fix every person to be just like you want them to be. Well, what ends up happening is that usually drives people away. It doesn't bring them to Jesus. It pushes them out away from Jesus. And so this is a really important principle in the context of a bad government, but it's just a good idea in general. In Daniel 4, you can read the story of Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. God gave the guy two dreams, and he doesn't believe in him. He's not a follower of God. I believe that Christians, no matter their circumstances, should absolutely be telling the story of the gospel wherever and whenever they get a chance. But God hasn't called us to be pushy. So look how Daniel responds to Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel had been a trusted advisor for Nebuchadnezzar for some time, and this is years have gone by, and he's standing around, and he's looking at his country, his city, and he's like, look at this beautiful place that I've built. And God says, no, no, no. And he gives him this dream that he doesn't understand. And when Daniel comes to interpret the dream, he didn't push himself on Nebuchadnezzar. He was invited in. And notice how he talks in Daniel 4, verse 27. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. I don't know what relationship Daniel had developed with the king. I'm guessing that he knew about Daniel's God, that this wasn't a random thing. But when Daniel came, he hadn't been telling the king for years, you should be kinder, you shouldn't do this, you should do that. He wasn't fixing the king. But when God initiated, the door was open, Nebuchadnezzar invited him, he did not hold the truth back. He didn't mince words. He said, this is sin, change your ways. I don't think that's an easy message to give. And I think it's important that we hold both of these things as true in our lives. First, that we wait for the Holy Spirit to open doors. We should not push God on other people without God's leading. And secondly, that we should never pull back from communicating God's truth when he's opened the door. We shouldn't mince words and make it all nice and fluffy. We should be true to God's message. Wait for God, but give his truth clearly. There's a bit of trivia in this story. Nebuchadnezzar spends 7 years eating grass like an ox after this vision because God was humbling his heart. What happened during those 7 years? We don't know. It's not clear. There's a kind of a blank space in the public record in Babylon, and there's a lot of records from Babylon back in the day. And there's kind of this blank space that we don't really know what happened. Well, I suspect that the kingdom was held by the only guy in the administration who was humble enough to be a good civil servant and hold the throne for the king. I think Daniel probably took the government for those 7 years. I mean, anybody else would have just like kicked the king out, overthrown his government, and done their own thing. But Daniel doesn't do that. And I think it's super important for us to recognize that God is asking us to be humble and to wait for him. We wait for him to overthrow the king. We wait for him to set up the king that he wants. We wait for him to open the door for us to have the conversation with the king, right? We are the ones who are available, but he is the one who's leading. That humility is important for a Christian living in the context of difficult circumstances and bad governments. Our third principle for living in a bad government is that one must be honest, have integrity, do excellent work, you know, all of those things, and stay devoted to God. I think we probably we don't value this point well enough. Our integrity has a huge impact on how people see God. If we are people that aren't trustworthy, then how can people think God is trustworthy? Long after Nebuchadnezzar had died and after the Medo-Persian Empire had overthrown Babylon, Daniel is such a guy with integrity and skill that he's invited to be part of this new government, a completely different empire. and he's invited into the top ranks. He wasn't well-liked by the people who worked under him, though. And it wasn't because he did a bad job. It was because they wanted greed, you know, power and control, and they didn't like that Daniel had what they wanted. And so they tried to dig up dirt on him, trying to fire him, I suppose, or some version of firing him. Probably it would mean his death. Well, Daniel 6:4 reminds us, these administrators and high officials or officers began searching for some fault in the way Daniel was handling government affairs, but they could find nothing to criticize or condemn. He was faithful, always responsible, and completely trustworthy. So they concluded our only chance of finding grounds for accusing Daniel will be in connection with the rules of his religion. I think this is one of Daniel's chief witnesses about God. He lives a life of integrity. Nobody can look into his life and find the affair that he committed. Right? Nobody can look up the prostitute that he was hanging around with. Right? This is not Daniel's way of living. And you couldn't look into the records and find that he had stolen from the government or that he was making money on this side with some, what do they call it when you have a insider trading or something like this. There's nothing like that in his life. There's no fraud in his life. His heart is pure, no dirt on him. And so they decide to pit Daniel's faith against Darius's pride and desire for loyalty. In Daniel 6:7, they say, all the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. After this decree is signed, Daniel does what he's always done. He goes and he prays to his God. And all the bad guys gather outside his house because they know that he's going to do it. He's predictable. He's got integrity. And he's going to worship his God in spite of this law. And Daniel, unflinching in his devotion to God, no matter the laws, prays. He wasn't disrespectful, but he also didn't hide. Look in Daniel 6, verse 10. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. Full of integrity and faithfully devoted to God, no matter the cost. This part of the story is where I believe the rubber meets the road in our circumstances today. God has given us freedoms that can't be taken away by our government, no matter the laws that they put in place, no matter the president or form of government that we see. These are things we don't need to be afraid of. God is the one who is the architect of history. He is the one who sets up kings and takes them down, who allows laws or doesn't. No person or law can remove your freedom to worship God according to your conscience, even if they threaten you with torture or death. Only you can choose who your heart is devoted to. Daniel was prosecuted for violating this law, and he was sentenced to death by the den of lions. And notice what happened to the king. When Daniel, this man of integrity, was sent to the lion's den. I think God uses the contrast between Daniel's integrity and these bad guys in the government, these nefarious, devious colleagues of Daniel's, to wake up the king's mind. He recognizes the guy who he's sending to death is a guy that's full of integrity and loyalty. And the guys that brought this about are not good. And it starts to awaken his mind to the love and power of God. And all through the night, the king was restless and uncertain. And as soon as it was light, he gathered some soldiers and he went to the den of lions and he called out, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" The fact that he's even asking this question reveals something about his belief, the beginnings of belief in this God of Daniel. Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me. But because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm. I make a decree." The interesting thing about this, I don't know the story behind Daniel, or Darius rather. I don't know all of the things. I do know that he was likely only in power for 2 years after Babylon was conquered. And so this is probably shortly after the new government is formed that this experience is happening. And he doesn't live much longer, a year and a half, and Darius ends up dying. But at the end of this story, Darius says these things about God. He says, "I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." It's hard to beat Daniel's record as an influencer of nations, isn't it? He was influential in the conversion of the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and possibly the conversion of Darius, the king of the Medes and the Persians. It's hard to beat that record, and yet he's not a political activist. He's making a difference, but he's making a difference as a servant, a humble servant of God, and a good servant of his government. As we consider how to live both as citizens of heaven and citizens of this nation, we should follow Daniel's example. I think, anyway. I think it's the best example for how we should relate in a world where we have a lot of upheaval in our politics and uncertainty. Maybe things aren't going to go the way we would hope they would go in our government. We have the ability to interact in different ways maybe in our government than some others have. We don't have lots of persecution in this moment in our place, but that's not the case for many Christians around the world who face persecution every day. My guess is that Daniel, in the lion's den, in the moment of his potentially worst fears, he's going to die, he's going to be eaten, some terrible death. I think that he was remembering some things that we should keep in mind. Psalm 46:1 tells us, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble." God is present in our trouble. In Psalm 23:4, he says, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." You are with me. Or from the promises of a more recent prophet in Daniel's day, Isaiah. He says this in Isaiah 43:1. "But now thus says the Lord, who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you, I have called you by name, you are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." In trial, God is with us. Isaiah 12 reminds us of this. "Shout and sing for joy, O inhabitants of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel." The most important thing that we can know about living in a bad government is that God has promised to be with us. Our morality doesn't come from our culture and our society. Our integrity doesn't come from the business models around us. Our freedom doesn't come from the laws of the land. God is the source of our morality. He is the source and sustainer of our integrity. He is the one who gives us freedom of conscience. And he promises to be with his people who live in the most oppressive environments. You and I live in a fairly comfortable environment, and it's probably, I'm talking about this idea of living in a bad government, and you're like, well, it's not really here. It's not really what we see. And that's true. Right now, it looks pretty good. But that's not the case for a lot of people around the world. According to Open Doors USA, if you lived in North Korea or Somalia or Libya or Eritrea or Yemen or Iran, being a Christian could be a death sentence for you. Right now, today, God's people are being persecuted all around the world. And we live in a bit of a bubble. We complain about our politics. But I think whether we live in in North Korea or the United States, the principles of living a godly life are the same. And whether we're talking to a king or a next-door neighbor, the principles of living a Christian life in the secular nation are the same. We can certainly, in our country today, rise up and protest the state of our media or our government. We can say all the things that we want to say about it. We can complain about the border policies or about humanistic philosophies and federally mandated education. And we're even free to vote our conscience about bills and legislators. We have a huge amount of freedom. But I want you to understand that this freedom is not a duty of the Christian, nor is it a guarantee of our God. Our duty is to live for and worship God no matter the cost, to be faithful and diligent in our work, and to be above reproach in our community, and to share the truth about God as He opens the doors. God says that He will be with us. He doesn't promise that everything will be good all the time. He doesn't even promise that we're going to be saved from death or from persecution. What He does promise is that anything that happens to us is something He can fix, because He can heal our bodies and He can raise us from the dead. So we don't need to be afraid of persecution, and we don't even need to be afraid of death, because He is the God who has conquered death. Because God is with us, we are free. Jesus says it this way: "If the Son therefore shall make you free, ye shall be free indeed." I'd like to play a song for you. Make sure that the AV guys have the volume up and everything. It's a song called The King Dreams. It's from Daniel chapter 2, and it's the story of the king who has a dream. But more than that, it's a story of the King of Kings, who has a dream not just about the rise and fall of nations, but a dream for your heart and a dream for mine. As I play the song, you're welcome to join as you catch the anthem a little bit and sing along. This will be our concluding song, but I want you to just let this idea that God is with you absorb into your hearts as we listen.